Coming up on Weekend America.
Think you've got campaign overload? This President's Day weekend, we look back to the campaign overload of yesteryear.
You know, there's no movies, no TV. So it was a huge party. People would come and vote and would get drunk.
Mm-hmm. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. In Chicago this weekend, an art exhibit of some of the nation's most wanted.
These guys that just look so evil. I don't even want to handle the photos because I feel like that evil is going to rub off somehow.
Ooh, do mugshots belong on gallery walls? And the Seattle Sonics are home this weekend, but home might be about to change.
You know, there's a crime being committed, it feels like. I mean, it feels like this guy is just walking in brazenly and just killing our team in front of us and, you know, dragging the corpse off to Oklahoma.
Can you love them when they're about to leave? Weekend America starts after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to President's Day weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in the Twin Cities. As we choose a new president, the candidates are debating the issue of immigration. Later this hour, a Korean immigrant who's lived here 30 years decides to become a U.S. citizen, but not to tell her daughter. We bring you her story. So, if you were designing a test that immigrants have to take to become a citizen, what questions would you ask?
The first thing that popped in my mind would just be the why question.
Why do they want to become a citizen?
If somebody invaded this country, would you help defend it?
Who is the most famous American author? I'd like them to know, so they can tell me.
What goals and aspirations do they have to help America?
Are you willing to root for the Boston Red Sox?
Something silly, like what's the major ingredient in apple pie?
And if you had to answer that right now?
Crust. The crust is more important than anything. More important than the apples.
What if we actually wrote our citizenship test that way? What is the best color on the American flag?
I look good in red. Those voices came to us from Brooklyn, Cincinnati, Bothell, Washington, and Durham, North Carolina.
Well, this is the radio show about what's happening in America this weekend and across the nation on the Sunday talk shows, the week in review opinion pieces. The soap opera questions continue. Can Hillary recover? Will Huckabee back off? And who will burn with resentment this fall? Between the breathless punditry, the dramatic campaign ads, and our political passions, this campaign is threatening to take over our waking lives. Was there a time when America didn't emotionally obsess over its presidential contests, when the candidates and the process were more dignified? Here to answer is Weekend America's Nate DeMeo.
Over the course of 100 days in the fall of 1896, William Jennings Bryan gave more than 500 speeches. He was the Democratic nominee, and his presidential campaign was broke. So he took his message directly to just about every Midwestern town with a train station and a soapbox. Several million people showed up. The guy could rock a speech.
A republic in which every citizen is a sovereign, but in which no one cares to wear a crown.
That's Bryan a few years later in a recording studio. So picture him with 10,000 screaming Nebraskans behind him.
Or bowed beneath the weight of their own armaments.
And you could see what his Republican rival was up against.
You had William McKinley, who knew right away that he was going to lose in any head-to-head battle with Bryan if it came down to personality, if it came down to oratory.
That's historian Jennifer Burns.
He said, I might as well put a trapeze in my front lawn and try to compete with a professional gymnast if I go up against Bryan.
So he didn't, with Bryan thrilling crowds with his charisma and his rousing speechifying. McKinley relied on a well-funded and highly skilled network of political operatives and entrenched party loyalists. Then he just sat back and let them do the work.
So he simply sat on his front porch and let people come to him.
Welcome to the world of pre-modern presidential campaigns. A time when if you wanted to know what William McKinley or James Garfield or Benjamin Harrison thought about trade policy or international affairs or whatever, you could literally get some friends together, knock on the candidate's front door, and he'd tell you. But he wasn't going to come to you.
It was essentially this idea that you're trying too hard. You know, if you want the presidency, there's something almost inherently problematic about that.
George Washington set a model.
Historian Edward J. Larson says, thanks to our first president, for more than a century, there was this idea that the office should seek the man. The man should not seek the office.
George Washington came from the Virginia elite, where people stood for office at the call of the people. And it was improper to campaign.
Which was easy for George Washington because the dude was George Washington. But after that, if you wanted to appear presidential, you wanted to appear Washingtonian. And it becomes bad form to go out and let people know that you actually want the job.
Behind the scenes, they campaigned a lot.
Larson says as early as 1800, rivals Thomas Jefferson and John Adams were writing anonymous articles slagging each other. They were setting up partisan newspapers. They were paying people to write smear articles. And their campaign committees were inventing the American election. They had people canvassing for votes, bringing people to the polls. In New York, Jefferson's future vice president, Aaron Burr, was circumventing the rule that only people that owned land could cast ballots.
He would buy a small tract of land and put it in the names of maybe 400, 500, 1,000 immigrants. And suddenly, they'd all be property owners, so they could all vote.
If a presidential candidate was more passive, that doesn't mean that presidential campaigns weren't full of passion, full of conflict, rumor, innuendo, aspersions on the candidate's sexual lives. Mudslinging is absolutely nothing new to the American political system.
The voting public hung on every bit of news. The white, landholding, male voting public loved it. Michael Holt teaches history at the University of Virginia. He says elections were fun.
There was a lot of folderol and hurrah techniques and mass meetings and swilling the electorate with free hard cider and whiskey and all this.
And who doesn't love some folderol? Jennifer Burns points out that it's not like these people had anything better to do.
If you think of what the entertainment options were at that time, there weren't many. You know, there's no movies, no TV. So it was a huge party. People would come and vote and would get drunk.
Turnout was often incredibly high. More than 80% of the electorate voted in the 1876 election. That despite the fact that the candidates never personally stumped for votes or went on Leno. Michael Holt says that presidents of the past would never believe what's required of presidents of today.
The personal campaigning would leave most 19th century presidential candidates or hopefuls dumbstruck.
But he says the electorate is better off now than it was a century ago. During today's campaigns, you see the candidates in all sorts of situations, under extreme pressure. And you get a sense of what they might be like as president.
Demands on the modern candidate are so intense, having your every word, thought, emotional moment parsed, repeated endlessly on the internet.
Jennifer Burns wonders if we're past that notion, that we want the office to seek the man or woman, not the other way around.
The type of person who can withstand that scrutiny is perhaps what Americans of a past generation were afraid of. It's someone who really wants power and prestige, because only someone who's really ambitious will subject themselves to that type of treatment.
Perhaps we should all meet up at McCain's or Huckabee's or Clinton's or Obama's house and knock on the door and ask them about that. I'm Nate DeMeo for Weekend America.
This week, the Writers Guild of America reached an agreement with big media studios, and that ended a 100-day strike that, by some estimates, cost the entertainment industry $2 billion. The writers and the studio executives have settled, but it's going to be a while before production crews get started again, and that means that the writers are working, but some behind-the-scenes workers still aren't.
Because of the battle between producers and writers, the television shows are not working. And we are also out of work.
That's an out-of-work costume designer. Last weekend, reporter Eve Tro met several costumers at a parking lot sale in North Hollywood, California. They were selling their wares, literally, to raise money for their union.
Coming up, fire sale, dollar for everything on the table for the welfare fund for 705.
The Costumers Local 705 is a union for wardrobe workers in Hollywood. Members gathered on a Saturday morning to sell pieces from their collections. Beaded gowns, work shirts, bouffant wigs, all costumes left over from previous jobs.
Now you got
three, four bags here, and she's getting more over there, and we got some in the truck.
Yeah, she's got the checkbook out.
Yes, she does. She's been spending very well today, too.
I got some wonderful stuff. An original dress. Got the little flapper bottom. Normally, maybe $200, and I got it for $20.
Some of that money will go into the union's welfare fund. It provides low-interest loans for out-of-work costumers. Loan applications have tripled since the writer's strike began in November.
So how much is this $3 jacket? And they'll say $1.50.
A few dozen people wander through the racks of shirts and dresses that line the parking lot. One of the big selling points is who wore the clothes.
I worked with Jimmy Kimmel for about 8 years on The Man Show. And I'm selling vintage ties. I have vintage pants and vintage scarves.
Lisa Snee has done costume work for talk shows, dramas, indie movies. She's been in the business about 30 years.
My husband and myself are both in the entertainment industry. He's a Teamster and I'm a costumer. And he's been out of work since November. So I'm back into doing what I can do.
With both of them out of work, money has been tight. To make her costumes easier to sell, Lisa has redesigned them.
I have the vintage pants. I cut the waistband out of the pants and lower them. You know, I can make capris out of the pants.
Some 705ers have had to take non-union gigs to pay the bills. This woman didn't want to give her name. She's here today selling clothes with a friend.
We're both out of work 705 customers, but I'm working elsewhere in order to make ends meet. I'm currently working in a sidebar business, also costuming, but for Disneyland Resort.
Even though the strike is over and the writers and producers are back to work, she is not.
The executive producer for the show that I work on said that it would be 11 weeks from the time the writers started writing until we had enough scripts to start working again.
Since most of the work is freelance, a majority of costumers don't have a steady gig to go back to. But Simone Williams sees events like today's costume sale as a way to meet people and maybe land her next job.
I'm networking. I figure a lot of costume people are going to be here, and I need to get my resume to people and meet them. Hopefully some really, really good creature movie, monster, special effects movies will get started. That's the kind of work I like to do.
These are nice, baby.
In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Troe for Weekend America.
Des, I have a screenwriter friend here in Los Angeles who, when her union, the Writers Union, went on strike, she was right in the middle of developing a script with a studio. Mm-hmm. So for the last 3 months, she's supposedly not been rewriting her script. You know, she's not supposed to, but she tells me the industry nods and winks at that rule.
Well, you know, it's a good thing that she got feedback on the script before the strike, because then she had, you know, something to work on. And it makes perfect sense that if you're out of work, you've got plenty of time. Why not use that time to get ahead?
Yeah, tell that to the union, though, you know. So now the thing is, she's got all these changes to her screenplay that she officially miraculously came up with in the last 3 days.
Voila! Well, maybe that'll, you know, hasten some of that time it's going to take to get other people who have been affected by the strike, get them back to work, like those costumers we just heard about. Or you think about other people, the sandwich vendors. Or there's just so many industries that were hanging on to the strike being over and getting people back to producing those shows that we all love. You're listening to Weekend America.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Coming up, a satellite shoot down, middle school dances shut down, and drunk drivers are dressed down publicly. Is it good news, bad news, or no news? That's next on Weekend America. We'll be right back. You're listening to Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles with Desiree Cooper. And this weekend, the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, also known as LACMA, opens its new contemporary art expansion. This is clearly good news for LACMA's director, Michael Govan. But alas, much of life is more shaded than that. So Michael Govan is with us now to assess the week's news in our regular weekly segment, Good News, Bad News, or No News. Michael, welcome.
Thank you, Bill.
Susan Jacoby is the author of the new book, The Age of American Unreason. Welcome, Susan.
Glad to be here.
And our friend David Rakoff, his latest book is called Don't Get Too Comfortable. Hey, David.
Hi, Bill.
Our first topic. In a few days, the Pentagon will try to shoot down a failing spy satellite. The White House says the satellite is out of control and could land in a populated area with its fuel turning into a deadly toxic gas. So is this good news or bad news or no news?
I'll start. It's bad news because it's one of those stories that makes me think about things that there's no point in thinking about,
right,
such as satellites falling out of the air, and this also applies to asteroids falling out of the air.
Mm.
But it also makes me think with extra anger. They're putting all this effort into shooting down a satellite that apparently hasn't been operational since the day they shot it up.
Yeah. Right. Well, when you can't get the real villains, you can always shoot down your own satellite.
There you go.
I don't know. It struck me as no news because, you know, satellites get destroyed all the time and the Earth is mostly uninhabited. So it's not the chance of it actually hitting something if the parts that aren't burned up on reentry are very slim. But then the sort of 3 days of the Condor conspiracy theorist kicks in. And I think it's like, well, it's no news that we know of, because after all, it's a spy satellite.
Right.
You know, and the Chinese, there was mention in the news item of the Chinese possibly developing some sort of a satellite missile system. So, again, I keep on thinking, you know, no news.
But if you've paid $9 to see this happen in the theater, isn't it good news that we're getting it for free?
I don't think we're going to get to see it.
I don't think we're going to get to see it.
Yeah,
no.
Only if it's televised. I think we should require that, at least, so we know where our money's going.
Yeah. Doesn't that seem like our basic right if we're going to fund this as taxpayers?
I would like it to be truly awesome. I would like to see Jennifer Garner shoot the missile. And I'd like her to say something pithy and double entendre, like something like, this relationship isn't working out for either of us.
Our next topic. A Washington state senator has proposed a new deterrent to drunk driving. If you've been convicted, once you get your driving privilege back, you have to sport a fluorescent yellow license plate for 1 year. Is this approach good news, bad news, or no news?
Good news. I have always thought that the public stocks ought to be restored for certain kinds of offenses. I think also, in a practical sense, this is very good legislation. Drunk drivers are well-known recidivists. I see a drunk driver license, I give the car as wide a berth as I can. A good idea.
Susan says good news. Others?
Yeah, I don't actually have a real problem with it. It's not like there's that old... kept on reading the Scarlet Letter metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
Drunk driving is not an infraction of sort of a subjective morality.
Exactly. You know,
it's like, well, maybe my idea of drunk driving isn't your idea of drunk driving. Drunk driving is kind of drunk driving. It's kind of terrible for the body politic. And I don't really have a lot of sympathy for someone who drinks and then gets behind the wheel of a car for other people to know. But then again, you know, I hate baseball and freedom, so I'm the wrong guy to ask.
So there's that.
Yeah.
Michael, are you joining the chorus?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's good news that the spotlight's being pointed at a real issue, and I think the Scarlet Letter metaphor isn't correct. This is it's a statistical fact. So the modest proposal, if you will, is not a bad way to focus people's attentions on a real problem.
One of the bad news arguments is that it's fine in theory, but that in practice, this encourages vigilantism. It encourages police to use the plates as probable cause. That we get into psychological reactions that we don't really want to get into.
There's one way to prevent that. It's for drunk drivers not to get in their cars and drive.
You also have to, in a nation that prides itself on some possibility for rehabilitation, you have to say, what will get rid of your plate and how quickly can you do that?
Our final topic. In Frankfort, Illinois, school officials have been appalled by the behavior at middle school dances. These young couples grope and grind and cuss and disrespect the grown-ups. Therefore, young lady, the district has canceled all dances for the rest of the year. The parents are divided. What about you, panel? Good news, bad news, or no news?
I just find it fascinating that the school officials didn't, that nobody paused before this and thought, we're actually being one of those 1950s teen pictures. I mean, that literally nobody thought, in what ways are we hewing so closely to a caricature of the Colonel Blimp school official that we might want to actually dial it down a little bit?
I have a 13-year-old in public school in New York. Kids are exposed to everything now. That's the information age. They're exposed to everything, which redoubles the need to find other ways to communicate and educate and have kids think about their own responsibility, right? I mean, you're not going to cancel dances. How could you cancel a part of childhood? That's ridiculous.
That's the news here, is not the parental disapproval, but the school district canceling all dances for the rest of the year.
That seems pretty mean.
I like the way they're going to replace that with ski trips, as if that's going to be any better.
Yes.
Yeah, I saw that movie, too. Hey, guys, it looks like we're snowed in at the lodge, and there's only three bedrooms.
You know, when this started, Michael, was when painters started doing nudes. That's where things started falling apart.
We don't show those.
Oh, thank goodness.
Of course, that's nothing compared to what my 13-year-old sees in the movie theater, so it's a ridiculous comparison.
Yes.
You know, but we have a nice space here. If they want to travel to L.A., we'll give them space to dance.
Okay, everyone, we're partying at LACMA.
That's all we do this week with the opening of the museum, so they might as well join the party.
True. That's the news this week. Panel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Govan is director of the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. This weekend is the opening of LACMA's new expansion, the Broad Contemporary Art Museum. Susan Jacoby is the author of The Age of American Unreason, and David Rakoff is the author of Don't Get Too Comfortable, The Indignities of Coach Class, The Torments of Low Thread Count, The Never-Ending Quest for Artisanal Olive Oil, and Other First World Problems.
Looking ahead to next weekend now, the end of the writer's strikes means that the Academy Awards are going to happen on Sunday.
My favorite part of the Oscars is the tribute montage of the great film scenes of the greatest one-liners in Hollywood history. And here on Weekend America, we'd like to hear your all-time favorite movie lines.
My favorite movie line of all time is, "I don't want to be a pie." It's from Chicken Run.
And why is that your favorite line?
Well, it's such a pathetic plea to avoid the inevitable. I whine it all the time. Every time I have to do something that I don't want to do.
I don't want to be a pie. My wife and I first came together over Dumb and Dumber, so we'll still say, we got no food, no jobs, our pets' heads are falling off!
Oh, gosh.
That's when things get bad, you know. What about you, listeners? What's your most memorable movie line and why?
Yeah, did it make you laugh or cry, or does it just take you back into time?
Maybe you started saying it all the time, or maybe you cringe at the words. Tell us the story.
Tell us at our website, weekendamerica.org.
And once you go to that website, you'll be back.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
After giving her daughter her all, an immigrant mom finally gives something to herself. Coming up on Weekend America. From American Public Media, hope you're having a great weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. And this weekend, our friends Erin McKittrick and her husband, Brett Wood, Hig Higman, are still walking. We talked to them the weekend they left Seattle in June, 8 months ago. Since then, they have been headed to Unimak Island, Alaska, without motors, walking, rowing, and skiing for 4,000 miles. And they've been checking in with us all along the way.
Well, they're doing it partly for the adventure, but also to draw attention to environmental issues. Erin and Hig called us recently from Anchorage, where they've been hiking and camping at 20 below.
In the worst conditions, there's still two amazingly cool things that happen every day, and one of them is dinner and the other one is sleep. We conk out after a hard day's physical work, but the hard part of every night is getting up in the morning. In the winter, that's just really a tough thing, and you know, you stick your nose out and your nose feels like it's getting frost on it. You know, it's just bitterly cold out.
Especially since in the winter, it's often still dark at this time. One of our favorite meals is spaghetti with cheese, lots of butter, milk powder, a little bit of curry powder for spice. But as it's gotten to be winter, in minus 20 degree weather, if you want any of those things, particularly the cheese, to be something other than one big, huge frozen block, you have to wear it inside your clothes. And that's true for water. You know, we don't have a whole lot of extra fat on us, but if you were to see us outside, we have this huge sort of blocky, bulky blob in on our fronts because we've stuffed, you know, almost everything that we need to keep warm inside our clothing. So when we started this trip in June, you know, I was in okay shape, but not that great. You know, so at the beginning we were tired and we had blisters, and then over the course of the trip, of course, I'm now in better shape than I've ever been in my entire life and probably ever will be. And the other day I was walking through a little park here to go pick up groceries, and they had a bunch of little exercise things in the park, and there was this chin-up bar, and I went over there. I've never been able to do a chin-up in my entire life, and I walked over to it just curious, and I could do several, no problem.
We went through this section, this open coast section, so it's on the Gulf of Alaska. Some people call it the Lost Coast. It's a very, very remote area of Alaska. It's very difficult to access.
Big and sand beaches, a lot of surf, like California if you subtract people and add glaciers.
And in the, I don't know, we were out there maybe a month and a half or something like that. We had 14 storms that were, each one like was very intense. You know, it would be big national news if it hit a major city, you know. We were walking along the beach. It was blowing from behind us, and it was getting to the point where it was pretty difficult walking even with the wind behind us, and we were running out of anything to hide behind. And we had water all the way around us because we were on the spit. And so we ended up camping by digging a hole in the sand and putting a blockade of driftwood around it. And actually, Erin fell asleep a little earlier than I did, but I lay awake listening to the storm. It was beautiful but scary. We do actually sing songs sometimes. We're both horrible singers. I'm worse than Erin. I'm one of those people that just ain't got no rhythm. But I find it really helpful, particularly on open water crossings where they're kind of boring, really. But you have to keep on going, and I find singing to be really useful there. Hello, darkness, my old friend.
Hello, darkness, my old friend.
Like a Simon and Garfunkel, I think.
I've come to talk with you again.
Both of us now have it popping into our heads, and we're like, gosh, we got to look up the lyrics to that so we can actually sing more than a verse or two. Yeah.
And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains.
Read Erin and Higg's blog and see their photos from the tundra at weekendamerica.org.
Wow, I'm just imagining walking with that food in your clothes. You know, ordinarily, you stand in front of the fridge with the door open to see what to make for dinner, and I guess in their case, they unzip their mates and stand there gazing.
I just hope they'll call again soon so I can read them the Sound of Silence lyrics. That's such a sad image, not knowing the words. This is Week in America.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, this is Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. The debate over illegal immigration has overshadowed the fact that every day people are working hard to become legal citizens of the United States.
So far in the new millennium, more than 4 million people have become naturalized citizens. And it's not a simple thing. The time between filling out the application and interviewing to become a citizen can be from a few months to several years.
Weekend America producer Angela Kim recently went to her first naturalization ceremony, her mom's. A year ago this weekend, her mom decided she would tackle the citizenship process. Angela had no idea.
My mom came to the United States from South Korea in 1977 and later became a permanent resident. For years, she made excuses on why she couldn't take the citizenship test, like how she was too busy with family and work. In the end, she rationalized a green card was good enough. That's why I was surprised when she called me one day and said, "I'm a citizen." I had no idea what she was talking about. "Citizen of what?" I asked. She proudly said, "Citizen of the United States of America." A month later, my mom asked me if I had the time to come to her swearing-in ceremony. I couldn't believe she was asking me. How could I miss something like that? Of course I'd be there. I wouldn't miss it for the world. The ceremony was at the Los Angeles Convention Center. It was a sunny Thursday morning. When I entered, people were split into two different entrances, new citizens to the left and guests to the right. Over 4,000 people, including my mom, became a citizen in L.A. that day. As I waited for the ceremony to start, I noticed this young woman standing next to me. She was about 18 or 19 years old. She looked bored. Turns out she was waiting for her mom to get her citizenship, too. She told me how she helped her mom study using flashcards. I admit it, I was jealous. I wanted to be the one holding the flashcards, quizzing my mom about the number of stripes on the flag and the American presidents. I turned to my dad and asked why they didn't tell me mom was studying to be a citizen. He said the process wasn't that important. He made it sound so trivial, as if the end result was the only thing that mattered. But the process was important. My mom studied for almost 9 months, and the whole time she kept it a secret from me. Growing up, I interpreted when we went out and translated documents for her. I've always been part of that process. My dad and I stood in the back and watched the sea of people all giving up their allegiance to the place they once called home.
That I absolutely and entirely,
that absolutely and entirely,
renounce and abjure,
renounce and abjure,
all allegiance. And
all I could think was somewhere in that crowd of voices was my mom. The ceremony was short, and the citizens were funneled to booths to pick up their naturalization certificate. That's my mom getting hers.
Congratulations.
Okay, thank you very much.
She couldn't take her eyes off that certificate. Outside the convention center, friends and family were cheering for their loved one, holding flowers and balloons. I felt like I was at a graduation. When we got home, my mom and I sat on the couch. She showed me her study guide and the things she learned. But still, the same question kept nagging at me. And I finally had to ask, why didn't she tell me she was applying to be a citizen? She looked at me and smiled before she spoke. She's saying, I know you're thinking mom can't speak English well and doesn't seem driven. There are things that a parent wants to show their child. I did that. And you can feel comforted by it. I was overcome by guilt. I had thought those things when I was younger. People asked how my parents could live in the U.S. for so long and not know how to speak English. I was embarrassed. I remember when I was a kid, I was in the backseat of the car, and I told my mom I would only speak English to them and I would never speak Korean again. I said, that's not what people speak here. I thought the knowledge of the language reflected a person's intelligence. All those memories kept flooding back to me as she sat there smiling, as if what I'd done in the past didn't bother her. I didn't know what to say, so I changed the subject. I had her tell me some of the things that she learned.
How many Supreme Court justices 몇 개 있어야 돼, 미국에?
Nine people.
I am proud of her. I'm not sure I could have done what she did. I didn't know how to say it to her right then and there, but I hope she knows. 엄마, 존경스러워요. Mom, I'm proud of you.
Angela Kim is a producer with Weekend America. Watch her mom become a citizen. Just go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
This is the radio show about what's happening this weekend. And in Chicago this weekend, photography connoisseurs can take in an unusual exhibition at the Intuit Gallery. It's a collection of vintage black and white portraits going back to the 19th century, each piece consisting of two photos, one in which the subject stares straight into the camera with an often unnerving gaze, and the other photo is in profile. Producer Jennifer Brandel met up with the exhibit's curator to learn what is so fascinating about mugshots.
Photography collector Mark Michelson is fascinated by the people who don't make it in the history books. When he went to Rome last year, he wasn't interested in the palaces. He wanted to see the slave quarters.
I wasn't really thinking about Julius Caesar or Mark Antony. I was thinking about the guy who laid the bricks. You know, what did he do at night? Where did he go home to? What did his house look like?
Michelson's the same way about photographs. He's never been into celebrity glossies. He collects old passports, ID cards, newspaper clippings. He looks for ordinary people from the past. Then one day, Michelson's hobby turned into an obsession. He was browsing eBay, and he came across a mugshot from the 1930s of a petty thief from Minnesota. It was stapled to a card with fingerprints and a crime report.
A man who was arrested for having two pairs of pants in his possession that he could not account for.
The Hispanic man had carefully coiffed curly hair, wore a tie, scarf, and a plaid button-up shirt. He gave the camera a deep, stoic stare. And the photo itself was a beautiful, high-quality silver print. Michelson immediately fell in love with mugshots. He says they may be small, but they're heavy.
The thing that gets me excited about mugshots is something that makes them different from a passport photo or a driver's license photo. When the shutter clicks on that camera, there's trouble.
He started buying mugshots off the internet and from antique dealers. Some of them go back to the 1870s. At first, it was just a three-ring binder's worth. But over the course of a decade, it became stacks of binders, and then boxes and boxes and boxes filled with mugshots. They now fill most of his tiny one-bedroom apartment. It's become the largest collection of mugshots in the world.
I have rich people and poor people. I have children, old folks. I got every kind of hooker and transvestite you could possibly imagine.
A fashion historian has already used Michelson's collection to map clothing trends. And the crime reports document the days when one could be arrested for immoral purposes, huckstering, and flim-flam. Like a little kid digging through baseball cards, Michelson sifts through piles of mugshots, hunting for his favorite faces.
Different photos grab me for different reasons, but there's definitely a feeling. I know it when I see it. It reaches out and grabs you. It pokes you. It pinches you.
He pulls out a photo from 1948. It's a weathered old man with sad, sunken eyes looking for forgiveness. Another keeper is a 12-year-old car thief with a slick blonde pompadour. He gives the camera a hardened sneer.
And this one, look at this black lady with this hairdo. 1941, and she's got like some Grace Jones kind of squared off afro in the profile. And I mean, she's kind of almost looks like a African queen or something. She's got this nobility about her.
Michelson's favorites end up on his Flickr site or a gallery wall. And the ones he doesn't like, stay home.
I have some at home in a box at the bottom of my closet. These guys that just look so evil. I mean, they're scary to look at. I don't even want to handle the photos because I feel like that evil is going to rub off somehow.
On opening night of Michelson's Least Wanted exhibit in Chicago, it's clear that he succeeded. Gallery goers aren't seeing these as faces of the bad guys. They're seeing friends and family.
I see things in all of these faces that remind me of somebody I know.
Our buddy Kunal Kulkarni looks exactly like that guy over there.
You start seeing people on the walls, and then you start looking for family. And then you turn around and look at the room, and you're like, whoa, they're all in mugshots and don't know it.
Oh.
one corner, the photos inspire two young men to break into an old Ukrainian folk song. It's about a bird that escapes from his cage, only to land in jail. The singers have an unusual audience. The eyes of the accused gaze at them from the past. These souls may have escaped their mortal coil, but they're captured on film forever. In Chicago, I'm Jennifer Brandel for Weekend America.
We have a marvelous gallery of these mugshots at our website, and the evil probably will not rub off on you at weekendamerica.org.
By Monday, the daytime high will be 5 in Truman, Minnesota, and in the mid-50s in Jefferson, Alabama. In Reagan, Texas, it'll be a sunny 61. For more weather, here's Week in America's John Moe.
Rain and 45 in Fredericksburg, Texas. Warm and sunny in the hearts of everyone at the Hug-In there. It's a Valentine's-themed weekend-long event with, they tell us, live music, cold beer, and fun. Also a group wedding. Not sure if that's a lot of couples hitching up or one huge group kind of co-marrying. I suppose that depends on how much of that cold beer and fun you have. Hawaii is known for many things, and none of them are rodeo. Nonetheless, Hilo hosts the Paniwa Stampede under sun, occasional showers, and 76 degrees. Look for food and craft booths, music, and rodeo competitions, including Hawaii's famed horseback surfing contest. Just kidding. Horses don't surf. They just hang out on the beach with fruity umbrella drinks. Lincoln, Kansas thought about which president to honor and decided to go with Lincoln. Clouds and 48 for a Lincoln weekend with drills by Civil War reenactors. Highlight of the weekend, Lincoln saying, "The name of the town is Lincoln, Kansas? After me? Does that mean I'm dead?" Actually, things get a little awkward at that point. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
A true sports fan sticks with her team through thick and thin. But what if the team doesn't stick with you? That's next on Weekend America.
Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at calvert.com.
It's Weekend America, the show about what's happening across the country this weekend. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. The NBA All-Star Game is this weekend in New Orleans, and on the roster will be zero members of the Seattle Sonics. Now, you could be nice and say that the Sonics are in a rebuilding mode, or you could be blunt and say they stink. But this is part of the deal for fans. You stick with the team when they're winning and when they're terrible. Lately, though, Sonics fans are wondering if there will even be a home team to stick with much longer. Weekend America's John Moe has a tale of ambivalence.
Here's something you don't normally hear a diehard sports fan say about his team.
I would like to think I'm a Sonics fan.
Paul Merrill grew up with the Seattle Supersonics, writes a blog about the team. Paul's the biggest Sonics fan I know. But when I met him for coffee the other day, He wasn't sure what he was anymore.
I'm not sure if the team playing right now is the Sonics. They may be the Oklahoma City Bombers. You know, I mean, I don't know who this team is out there.
Granted, Seattle is a city more prone to angst and self-analysis than most, all that coffee and rain, but there is a mood among basketball fans that stands in stark contrast to the raw, screaming energy that's supposed to accompany sports fandom. It's a darker mood, brought about by the 2006 sale of the team to a group of Oklahoma investors.
Right now, it's in court. The Sonics have applied to the NBA to move to Oklahoma City, but they have a lease at Key Arena through 2010.
That's Seth Colan. He's the executive editor of the magazine Sports Northwest, and like most locally born men, a lifelong Sonics fan.
It's a question of when they'll get to move the team. Will they get to move the team after this year? Not likely. After next year? Probably.
What's heartbreaking for fans is that in this fight, the bad guys, the guys who want to take the team away, are referred to as the Sonics, the same name of the team the fans have loved for over 40 years. Continuing to buy tickets puts money in those owners' pockets, but to walk away from the team violates the way you've been living as a fan for your whole life. You can't cheer, it feels wrong to boo, and you're too passionate to simply stop caring. Seth Colan is trying another approach.
I've sort of slowly been shifting my affiliation down south to the Blazers.
Portland.
I realize that if the Sonics leave, then the Blazers are, you know, our area's NBA team. So I'm the eye that I would normally be keeping on the Sonics, that eye is really looking at Portland right now.
So as your marriage crumbles, you're checking out the neighbor.
Precisely.
Thing is, the neighbor is a better match. The Portland Trailblazers are owned by a Seattleite. They have two starters from Seattle high schools, and their coach is a guy who spent his entire playing career with the Sonics. But the Blazers are also the Sonics' arch rival, making it all seem so wrong and so right. For some reason, the analogy of romantic love comes up a lot.
I thought about the Sonics as, especially Kevin Durant, this amazing young player, as the equivalent of meeting some very attractive girl who is everything you ever wanted, but she might be moving out of town. So, you know, do you invest all this in her, or do you just say, you know, I'll go with somebody who I know is going to be here?
The limbo of the Sonics is not only a personal issue either, it's also economic for Sam McDonald. He's the general manager at Floyd's Place, a barbecue joint and sports bar near Key Arena where the Sonics play.
A lot of people aren't coming out to games like they used to. I started here 7 years ago, and when I first started working here, this place was wall-to-wall packed on Sonics nights, especially on weekends. Our business is definitely off because of it.
Sam says the hardcore fans still cheer just as loud for the team, but even they seem to be carrying a weight on their shoulders, cheering for a team that doesn't want to be their team.
All around, it's just they want some kind of closure. They want an answer to what's going to happen with the Sonics. I don't know what's going on, you know, and I'd like to know what's going to happen with this.
Of course, what often ends up happening in these situations is that, yeah, the team leaves. So what would happen to these conversations then? The Brooklyn Dodgers baseball team moved to L.A. in 1958. Michael Shapiro is a professor at Columbia University and author of The Last Good Season, a book about the Dodgers and Brooklyn.
When the Dodgers left, what Brooklyn lost was a common topic of conversation. For 6 months of the year, for as long as anybody could remember, the Dodgers played baseball. When you took the team away, that conversation ended. The kind of conversations that you would have waiting for the bus, waiting for an elevator, waiting at the butcher shop, with strangers, in a way that really only happens when you have a team. It mattered. It made a difference.
So then it becomes not so much love gone bad as death. For now, Sonics fans are left with feelings similar to the stages of grief, denial, anger, bargaining, depression. Will they ever reach acceptance? No, says blogger Paul Merrill.
Well, maybe I don't want to accept it because, you know, there's a crime being committed. It feels like this guy is just walking in brazenly and just killing our team in front of us and, you know, dragging the corpse off to Oklahoma.
As we talked, Paul's six-year-old son James sat listening to his dad.
Well, James, do you like the Sonics?
Yeah.
Yeah? Who's your favorite player?
I like everyone in the Sonics.
In Seattle, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
I can't quite relate to the sports angst, Des, but what this makes me think of is the presidential campaign going on. Could an Obama supporter fall for Clinton? And if you loved Mitt Romney, could you marry John McCain?
Yeah, I guess at some point you just fall in line with what's best for the team, or in that case, the party. Or maybe you think of yourself as voting against the rival, not for your party's nominee. Or maybe just get a sense of humor about it, like this website that I found from the last election. It's actually called CarryHatersForCarry.com.
Yeah, you sent me that website. I love how they call themselves lukewarm, hostile Kerry supporters. And we all know what happened to that guy. It'll be very interesting to see into whose arms ambivalent voters fall this year. You're listening to Weekend America. Well, that's it for another hour of our program, American Public Media's Weekend America, which is produced with Ben Adair, Julia Barton, who this weekend is expecting her second child and trying to remember how to fold diapers, Neely Allel, Millie Jefferson, Sam Keenan, Jim Gates, who got a four-wheel drive for his winter in St. Paul and will spend this weekend trying to sell the Volvo, Michael Rayfield, Susie Lechtenberg, and Tim Bomba.
Also, Johnny Vince Evans, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Newnham, Phyllis Owens, who's going to see the Refugee All-Stars of Sierra Leone at UCLA, Angela Kim, John Moe, and Mark Sanchez, who's celebrating his anniversary in Chicago this weekend.
Yes, our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. And don't forget to go to our website. As we've been telling you all this month, we have little-known black history facts. And you can get a free podcast of today's program when you come see us at weekendamerica.org. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Hey, get out there. Enjoy your three-day weekend.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Picture this. It's Friday night or Saturday afternoon. You're home. No, wait. You're driving in your car. What song are you listening to?
It's really spastic, but it also has undertones of something a little bit more serious.
I'm on fire.
And
now I think
I'm
ready to bust a move.
I'm Bill Radke, the host of Weekend America. Join us each week as we capture the sound of your weekend.